from Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org. I'm Robbie Feinberg with the news on this day in Maine, Friday, December 3rd, 2021.
This Day in Maine is made possible by the Maine law firm of Eaton Peabody, serving generations of Maine families and businesses from offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland. And by Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, helping members stay healthy and happy with comprehensive coverage, smart digital health tools, and engaging well-being programs.
Maine is reporting 795 new cases of COVID-19 today. The Maine CDC says two more people have died and 329 are hospitalized. Two-thirds of the hospitalized patients are unvaccinated. The Delta variant is continuing to drive the surge of cases here in Maine. Some Mainers are complaining on social media that Walgreens is canceling appointments for COVID-19 booster shots. In response, the pharmacy chain says it's adjusting hours in some stores due to staffing needs and is working to reschedule appointments as quickly as possible. Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah acknowledged the issue during a briefing on Wednesday, which he said is the result of staffing and not a lack of supply. Shah says the CDC is working to bolster capacity at other sites to meet demand, including at the large-scale vaccination sites in Sanford and Auburn.
They're finally working with other providers to offer more, perhaps one-off days, large-scale clinics, because we know there's the demand out there.
As of Wednesday, roughly 30% of those eligible in Maine had received a booster. The University of Maine's mobile COVID-19 testing lab, run by a company called Shield T3 Health, says it can process 10,000 PCR tests per day on the Orono campus and quickly detect known COVID variants, including Delta and Omicron. Shield T3 Health CEO David Clark.
The testing at the University of Maine can pick up all known variants. And of course, Omicron now being a variant of interest as identified by the World Health Organization, it's important that we have that capability in the state of Maine to identify any of that virus.
Any positive cases of COVID must then be sequence tested by the Center for Disease Control to confirm the variant. No Omicron cases have been detected in Maine. A legislative commission is calling for the state to eliminate single-family zoning restrictions and growth caps on new affordable housing as part of a series of recommendations to address the state's housing crisis. Other suggestions include incentives for towns to reconsider their own zoning laws and to reduce parking rules and minimum lot sizes for developments. House Speaker Ryan Fecteau, who co-chaired the group, says the next challenge will be convincing lawmakers to take action.
Ultimately throw their support behind whatever we put forward as a bill or bills. And I hope that you will all be part of that process and helping us turn these recommendations into reality.
Fecteau has already submitted a concept bill for the upcoming legislative session to implement the panel's recommendations. A college aspiration program serving thousands of rural Maine students will likely end by next fall after its application for more federal funding was denied. The Gear Up Maine program has offered college counseling, career exploration, and financial assistance to rural Maine students from middle school through their first year of college. The program has operated through a series of federal grants, but the U.S. Department of Education rejected the latest application from the University of Maine at Farmington. Project Director Debbie Gilmer says the program has already been forced to lay off staff and wind down many services. She worries that could leave many students without crucial supports to help them stay in college.
But students not having the support, which we found so incredibly important for that transition, that period between high school and college, is just so critical, that coaching service. We're worried about that.
Maine's congressional delegation has already challenged the decision in a letter to U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona. The U.S. Department of Education didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. In the weather tonight, clear and cold, lows in the single digits in the north up to about 18 further south. Tomorrow, a bit milder, cloudy for all, highs in the 20s to 30s across the state with some snow showers at night. It's now time for Maine's Political Pulse, our weekly roundup and analysis of politics and government.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Maine Public Statehouse Bureau Chief and Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and political reporter Kevin Miller. The Supreme Court argument this week seemed to affirm most observers' belief that the conservative majority will uphold Mississippi's ban on abortions after 15 weeks. That would break the right to abortion outlined in Roe versus Wade. Some believe the court might go further, overturning Roe and returning abortion law back to the states. On this edition of The Pulse, a look at the arc of the abortion debate in Maine. Steve Missler, go ahead, take us back in time.
Well, Erwin, I think the first thing you should know is that politicians in this state, in the state legislature in particular, acted pretty quickly to make a woman's right to an abortion the state policy. In the mid-70s, just a couple of years after the Roe v. Wade decision, the legislature passed a law that basically did exactly that. And in 1994, the state bolstered those protections with the passage of the Reproductive Privacy Act by reaffirming a woman's right to end a pregnancy until fetal viability, which is roughly 23 weeks. Now, that law was shepherded by Governor John McKernan, a Republican, who was concerned that the anti-abortion backlash to the Roe decision was becoming increasingly violent, especially in other states where, you know, doctors were murdered or clinics were firebombed. You know, that didn't happen in Maine, but there were protests at clinics that were described in press accounts at the time as unrelenting. And from McKernan and others' perspective, potentially intimidating to women seeking access to the procedure. So McKernan viewed abortion rights as a constitutional protection, much the same way that the Supreme Court justices did who ruled 7-2 in the Roe case. And so with the help of the legislature, he backed a law that today stands, at least for now, as the safeguard if the current Supreme Court does what it appears ready to do, overturn Roe.
Interesting. So Mainers have a former Republican governor to thank for shepherding a bill that will preserve abortion rights here. But of course, what might happen if another Republican takes the Blaine House next year?
From the Democrats' perspective, Erwin, the next Republican governor, potentially Paula Page, will either weaken or remove those protections. This is the Democrats' rallying cry right now. I mean, this week, the Maine Democratic Party sent out a release that basically described Democratic Governor Janet Mills, a staunch abortion rights supporter, as the, quote, last line of defense for abortion rights here in the state. Campaign committees for Democratic legislative candidates are making a similar argument, arguing basically that electing GOP legislators next year could lead to restrictions of the procedure. You know, will that happen if Republicans can take the state house next year? Hard to know. I mean, we do know that they'll likely attempt to roll back some of the expansion of abortion access that Governor Mills has signed into law, including one in 2019. But it's also worth noting that efforts to restrict abortion in this state have largely failed. Even when Republicans held a trifecta here between 2011 and 2012, that was LePage's first term. That said, the abortion debate has tracked increasingly partisan since then. There are fewer pro-life Democrats, and there are definitely fewer pro-choice Republicans. It's become almost a litmus test for party affiliation. Additionally, let's not forget how the Supreme Court ended up with enough conservative justices to even consider scuttling Roe. Donald Trump made picking judges who would overturn Roe a centerpiece of his 2016 presidential campaign, a promise that solidified the GOP base, which includes evangelicals who have really strong views on this issue. And so while there may be pro-choice Republicans out there, they're in the minority and their ranks are shrinking. And it's been tracking that way for a really long time. I mean, in 2000, Senator Olympia Snowe tried to remove anti-abortion language from the national GOP's party platform. Snowe, who was married to McKernan, was unsuccessful, and she couldn't even get a majority of the Maine delegation to support her. So this trajectory has been going this way for a long time.
Well, Kevin Miller, this week's abortion argument also left Republican U.S. Senator Susan Collins scrambling to affirm her pro-choice bona fides.
Yeah, that's right. Senator Collins, you know, describes herself as a strongly pro-choice, and she's certainly been one of the most vocal supporters of abortion rights in the Republican Party. You know, there are a lot of abortion rights advocates out there and Democrats who come back and say that Senator Collins is not consistently supportive of abortion rights. Senator Collins really fell out of favor with these abortion rights groups when she voted for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. You know, they spent millions of dollars unsuccessfully trying to defeat her. So at the time, Senator Collins said that Justice Kavanaugh had repeatedly told her that Roe versus Wade and the other big abortion case, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, were, quote, settled law, and that he respected Supreme Court's precedent.
I could not vote for a judge who had demonstrated hostility to Roe v. Wade because it would indicate a lack of respect for precedent. What Judge Kavanaugh told me, and he's the first Supreme Court nominee that I've interviewed out of six who has told me this, is that he views precedent not just as a legal doctrine, but as rooted in our Constitution.
You know, but during Wednesday's oral arguments, Kavanaugh repeatedly pointed to previous instances where the Supreme Court had overturned earlier rulings in major cases, such as Brown versus Board of Education, which is the school segregation law. And a lot of observers interpreted this as a clear sign that he wants to overturn Roe as well.
That the prior precedents are seriously wrong, if that. Why then doesn't the history of this court's practice with respect to those cases tell us that the right answer is actually to return to the position of neutrality and not stick with those precedents in the same way that all those other cases didn't?
Now, this is exactly what abortion rights groups had predicted, you know, back during his confirmation hearing. So, you know, attention immediately turned to Senator Collins because she cast that pivotal vote for Justice Kavanaugh.
Okay, so what has she been saying since the Supreme Court hearing this week?
Yeah, she wasn't saying much this week. She once again reaffirmed her support for Roe versus Wade during, you know, brief interviews that we saw at the U.S. Capitol. But she said she hadn't watched the oral arguments and that she was not going to comment on them until after she had. But her office did generate headlines when they said that she would support passing a law to codify abortion rights in federal law. And this wasn't necessarily new to folks up here in Maine because she had said this a few months ago.
But to do all of that, of course, she would need to find the support in this Senate, at least, of at least nine other Republicans, which one would guess is impossible.
Exactly. And that's you know, certainly part of the discussion and the political calculations out there right now. The Democrats have a bill that passed the House with, you know, Democratic support that would codify this. Senator Collins has come out and said that she does not support that bill because she says it goes too far, and that she's having conversations with other senators about other ways to do this. But the reality is that in order to get anything done, you would have to get over that filibuster hurdle, which is 60 votes, and Republicans have 50 members of the Senate. And Senator Collins and Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska are the only two Republican senators out of those 50 who have a track record of supporting abortion rights.
Political reporter Kevin Miller, joined there by Maine Public's chief political correspondent and State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler. There's more political information on our Maine's Political Pulse newsletter available at mainepublic.org. You can also check out our podcast there. I'm Erwin Gratz, Maine Public Radio News.
The developers of a wind energy turbine off Monhegan Island are apologizing to Booth Bay residents angered by unannounced work in town last month, some of it on private property. And the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences is taking heat from locals as well for signing a deal to allow cable from the turbine to come ashore on its waterfront property there. Fred Bever reports.
The New England Aquaventus project aims to use deep waters off Monhegan to test an 11-megawatt turbine based on new floating platform technology that was developed at the University of Maine. It's a partnership between the university, the Mitsubishi Corporation, and RWE Renewables, a German energy giant.
We are here because we screwed up. I am not happy with my team from having done that. What we said last night, and I'll say it again tonight, is never again will we do that without telling people it's going to happen.
At a meeting in Boothbay Thursday night, project leader Chris Wissman said that to gauge soil suitability for an underground cable to run from the shore to a local substation, the company deployed surveyors last month to drill dozens of test borings, some of them inadvertently on private property. After publicly apologizing, he said that following discussions around the event, the company had already decided to avoid one particular area. And he emphasized that project planning is still in very early stages, promising more public consultation as specific routes become clearer. Many local residents, including Andrew Morley, were not placated.
Having this meeting after the fact sounds hollow to me because it's obviously you got caught with a hand in the cookie jar, and now you just want to pretend like you have our best interest at heart, but you don't.
Some residents also said they felt betrayed by the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences, which has agreed to let the cable come ashore at its waterfront property and will earn $200,000 over the easement's 20-year span. Eben Wilson, a local lobsterman, says a decades-long history of good relations between the community and the lab is at risk.
It's not something that came as a surprise to me, but I do feel that Bigelow failed miserably at communicating.
Wilson also sits on a wind energy task force put together by Governor Janet Mills, but he does oppose this project. He also says he understands why a scientific institution like Bigelow, dedicated to understanding and improving ocean health, would support the development of technologies that could help slow global warming.
They're seeing the effects of climate change in real time, and they're studying that, and that's very honorable and understandable. The problem is that they made this decision and they never communicated with the community that they reside in, and until very recently hadn't really thought this was going to be any form of an issue.
We were going to face the wrath of the fishing community. We didn't see any way around that. So how early do you open yourself up to, you know, what has been a national controversy?
Deborah Bronk is Bigelow's president. She says the lab does owe an apology for poor communications with residents upset about the possibility of cable being laid near their homes. But she adds that once completed, the visual impact will be small because most of the system will be buried. And she says, given the accelerating urgency of finding ways to slow climate change, she stands by the decision to support the wind project.
Am I going to apologize for signing the easement itself and saying we want to help this project move forward? No, I think we were right in doing that because we need this. Humanity needs this. If you care anything about the future that we're leaving our kids, we got to be pulling out all the stops, and this could be just incredibly powerful technology.
The developers aim to have what would be the nation's first floating platform wind turbine up and running in 2023. A larger 12-turbine research array Governor Mills is proposing to site in waters farther south could follow a few years after that. New England Aquaventus would also develop that project. Both projects are to be paid for by Maine electricity consumers. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And coming up on Maine Calling Monday morning at 11 o'clock, author, journalist, and international expert on corruption, Sarah Chase discusses her new book on corruption in America and what's at stake. I'm Robbie Feinberg. Thanks for listening.